my first talk, I mentioned that there are only three examples of classical biocontrol against Phytophagous mites. And what I'm going to show today is just the great potential that we see of using a specific group of fungal pathogen against spider mite and other kinds of Phytophagous mite. In the second part of my presentation, I'll be presenting some data on two projects that I'm working now, is the cassava green mite project and also the tomato red mite, both in Africa. So those are the three examples that I mentioned in the first talk. Two varieties of Cisutella thompsoni has been introduced into Argentina to control important citrus rust mite pests. And those projects, although they provide good control in the first year, the project was discontinued and the research never went back, and we don't have the information if those pathogens established or not. The third project is the cassava green mite project. This mite was introduced into Africa and soon became the most important pest on cassava. We have able to introduce a pathogen from Brazil. The name is Nosegaites tanahoa, and I'm going to show some data about this project. The other project that I'm working is the tomato red spider mite. It's a similar project. Again, it's a pest probably native from South America and was introduced into Africa. And now it's become an important problem in Europe also. It's established in Spain, Portugal, and south part of France. We have been able also to find fungal pathogen, the Nosegaites floridana, in Brazil. And I'm collaborating two other projects. You know, mites are moving everywhere. And one important project is the coconut mite. This is became an important pest on coconut plants in other palms also in Africa, in Asia. We don't have natural enemies at this point, but we're searching in Central and South America. The coconut mite is not a problem in those regions. And the last project is a more recent pest. This pest is Hawella indica. It's a mite that caused damage to palm plants in general, coconut, palm tree, palm oil. And it's introduced in the Caribbean. And it's now already in Venezuela, in French Guiana, and it's probably going to reach Brazil soon. In this project, we're planning to search for natural enemies in Sri Lanka and La Reunion. So I'm going to just give some data about the two first projects. But Nosegaites is a very interesting fungal pathogen. It has an intimate association with spider mite species. There are at least 16 species of spider mite that have been observed infected with the Nosegaites floridana pathogen. I believe this Nosegaites floridana is a complex of species, and as we start working more with these fungus, we see that there's a huge variability. And actually, when I start to work with the cassava green mite pathogen, it used to be called Nosegaites floridana also. And after many years of research, we figured out that was a different species. We described this as Nosegaites tanahoa. And it's probably that's going to happen with when people start to work with these pathogens of different spider mite. There are also other species, such as the Nosegaites abacarides. This species was described a couple years ago and was found in Poland infecting rust mite, the aerophyte mites, and it's only found in Poland. So I expect that this pathogen is probably in other places, in other countries, but nobody has actually looked at this. Why I think that Nosegaites is an important pest to use as a classical biocontrol agent. Here I list five characteristics of this pathogen. First, it has a very narrow host range. In some cases, it only infects a single species, so it's a good thing for a classical biocontrol agent. It's highly virulent. Only a single conidia is able to kill one host, so usually all Nosegaites is the only infect small arthropods that, such as thrips, and other small insects, mealybugs, for example. They produce a different kind of spore. They have a complex life cycle. Some spores are for short distance dissemination, others for long distance, some are for persistence in environment. They produce some, they call resting spores. So they have a way to survive in the environment without the host. The most important thing that they can regulate the host population. They are the most important natural enemies associated with spider mites. It's very common to find episodic and with really high levels of infection. I'm going to briefly show the life cycle of this pathogen. Usually the host die in a couple of days, 3, 4, 5 days, and they might become what's called mummified. This means that it is increasing size, and it only sporulates at night. Now, when humidity gets higher at night, it starts to discharge the conidia. It forms this conidiophore through the mite cuticle, and the conidia is discharged far from the host. It falls on the leaf surface, and this primary conidia, in a couple of hours, it starts to produce another conidia, that is the capillary conidia. It produces capillary tube up, all the cytoplasm go through, and then form this capilloconidia. That's the most persistent conidia compared to the primary conidia, and it's the only infective stage. And it's interesting that when the host is walking the leaf, this conidia has the drop-like stick end that glue to the mite body and then germinate and penetrate. But if the conidia doesn't get in contact with the mite, then it can produce another conidia up and another conidia up. And sometimes, for example, if the primary conidia falls between trichomes of the leaf and it doesn't reach, it can't reach the mite, so it can produce other conidia. Well, this is a really interesting association. So it makes this fungus so efficient in the field. Most fungi, they require very high humidity for sporulation. This is also the case with this pathogen. However, it can use very brief periods of high humidity to complete the most critical part of the life cycle, that this part that here, the sporulation and infection process. And then, you know, after you see a lot of conidia attached to the mite body or the mite body in general, mite legs, and then it develops as a hyphal bodies inside until it completes the life cycle in a couple of days. It produces different life stages, and I here just show that here is the resting spore inside of the mite. No. Different kind of spore here. So those spores are for long-term survival in the field. And it's also been observed that in temperate region, the fungus can survive inside of hibernating female during the whole winter, and then it can start to develop next season. So they have different strategy to survive, and we don't know much about temperate tropical place. We have been found some rest spore, but they're not very common. It probably that have different hosts. During the day, you see some dead mites. Usually late afternoon, they might die and become mummified. And it can survive a couple of days in this condition. But when humidity increases, just after 1 hour, at 95% or 100% humidity, the mites start absorbing water. You know, the fungus inside start absorbing water. You always see this condensation of water next to the mummified mite. And this humidity is used for production of the conidia, and the fungus discharge the conidia very far. Next day you go to the field, you're just going to see a cadaver. And what happened, most specialists, when they try to isolate fungus from those mites, they're only going to get saprophyte fungus. And even for the taxonomists that work spider mite, they are not aware of this pathogen. So that's one reason that people have never looked much about the how to work with this fungus, although it's very fastidious, difficult to work. It's also important to remember that those arthropods, they're really small. You know, the median body line of a mite is about 0.25 millimeters. So they live just only in the adaxial part of the leaf, next to the trichome, and not next to the stomata, where the transpiration is higher. And there's some studies showing that, you know, next to this boundary layer of the leaf, the humidity, even if the humidity in the environment is high, so the humidity next to the place, the environment that the mite lives, is a bit higher than the environment condition. So we have found episodic of this kind of spider mite even in semi-arid place in the northeast part of Brazil. Some mites produce a lot of web, and those web can retain the conidia. When the fungus discharge the conidia, all the conidia gets stuck. We see all this dot points here, and a lot of dead mites. Here's a cadaver, started the sporulation. You see a lot of conidiophore. So we started to work with the Cassava Green Mite Project many years ago. Cassava is a plant that is probably originated in, it was domesticated in the Amazon part of Brazil. Cassava was only introduced into Africa some 400 years ago. The Portuguese discovered Brazil and then they brought cassava into Africa. And only in the early 70s that the cassava green mite was introduced into Africa and soon became, you know, one of the most important pests. We started to work on this project in 1989. So the project started a couple of years before, but the most of the focus was to introduce predatory mites into Africa. This project was conceived by the International Institute for Tropical Agriculture in Benin. And after working about 9 years, we were able to send some isolates to Amsterdam for quarantine, and then this was then introduced into Africa and released. As part of my PhD, I did some molecular work for species identification, for strain also identification at Cornell. And we have done a lot of exploration, a lot of work in Brazil also. Well, cassava is it's an important crop in South America, but Africa is the biggest, you know, producer of cassava today. It's a crop rich in starch, and it's mostly used for human consumption, although it's also used for animal feeding. In Africa, they also eat the leaves of cassava. And here you see a healthy plant, healthy crop here. And in Africa, up to 80% of crop reduction yield was observed after introduction. And it caused chlorosis and then defoliation and reduced the yield production. So during this 18 years that we have been working on this project, we were able to accomplish all the steps of a classical biocontrol program. Now we start doing exploration, searching for natural enemies in Brazil. We have done a lot of laboratory studies to select the most efficient strains. Epizootiology studies also in the field in Brazil to accomplish all the requirements for international movement of pathogen. We have done non-targeted studies. And later, we have done some genetic comparisons of strains from Brazil, Africa, and other places also. I'm going to show some data about monitoring those releases later. So we were able to collect isolate in most part of Brazil and also in Colombia. Later on, we went to Africa because we found that there's some endemic strains also occur in Africa, but it seems that those strains, they have no impact on the host population in Africa. But it was important for, before release, we were able to distinguish the native from the exotic strains. So I have done also a lot of collection in Benin, Africa. So to fulfill all those requirements for international, you know, international regulation by FAO, we have done non-targeted study with beneficial insects, some other predatory mites, insects that are associated with the cassava ecosystem. We also compare with other spider mite species, the same family that the cassava green mite belong. We're never able to infect any other host besides the cassava green mite. It's a very specific pathogen. So we use some genetic sequencing of the small subunit of ribosomal DNA. Was the last step before we described this as a new species. Sequence did not help us to separate strains. Then you did use some fingerprint techniques such as AFLP and RAPD, and then based on the polymorphism that we found in some Brazilian strains, we are able to sequence those polymorphisms and develop specific primers to be used to monitor the dispersion of Brazilian strains in Africa. Basically, this work, we collect samples from Africa, each, you know, mites from different places. Those mites are placed in a 96 well plate, like a PCR plate, each mite in a single one. And then we do a DNA extraction, run a PCR reaction with four primers. We have one set of primer that this is the first one here. it's our control primer. It means if the mite is infected, it's going to show this band here. If the mite is infected with a Brazilian strain, it's supposed to amplify this smaller band here, only if the strain is from Brazil. So we have done this with a couple isolates. We test this, and we test this against 5 isolates from Benin and then 18 isolates from Brazil. We have used different quality of DNA. The most important thing that we test is with cadavers, because cadavers, they also have the DNA from the host, DNA from other microbes. And it seems that the probes, the molecular probe that we developed, were working fine. So during this year, there is a student from IITA doing a PhD at Göttingen University in Germany, and he is actually using those molecular probes to detect if the pathogen is established or not in Benin. And also there's the planned introduction for Tanzania, Ghana, and other countries. So he went back collect isolates before the release and confirmed that those molecular probes actually are efficient in terms of separating the native from the exotic strains. Before the release, I mentioned that this fungus, there's some strains, native strains that occur, but only very low level of infections have been observed. The release were done in 2 years, 98 and 99. And after the release, just the first year, up to 45% infection level was detected. And only in the release sites where Brazilian strain were released, not in the control sites where native strain were released also. The release were done just by transferring infected mites. In 2001, up to 70% infection were observed, and infection were also detected 200 kilometers from the release site. And this year, using those molecular probes, they were able to confirm that the pathogen, the Brazilian strains, are established in Africa. So the next step of this project is probably to measure, to estimate the impact of the introduction in terms of host density and also the economic impact. The other project is the tomato red spider mite. It's a very similar project in the sense that we have a spider mite. This spider mite, it became established in many countries in Africa, mostly in southern and eastern Africa. We don't know the origin of the mite. So the information we have is that the Lycopersicum genus, the genus of the tomato plant, is native from probably Peru, Bolivia. And this mite is a specialist to Solanaceous plant. It can cause a lot of damage in Africa in tobacco, tomato, potato. It also can survive on eggplant and pepper and nightshade and many other Solanaceous plants. Also, we know that Evansi, the tomato red spider mite, was described based on samples collected in Brazil in 1954. The first natural enemies that was found associated with this pest was also found in Brazil, and it was Nelsigaites floridana. Those samples were sent to Richard Hamban, and he published this in 71. And also, before the 1970, this mite was also considered a pest in Brazil. So, but it's not a pest anymore. We don't know what happened since then. But after this paper about the Nelsigaites floridana associated with the mite, it's just the problem had been disappeared in most of the parts of the country. It was found the first time in Zimbabwe in 1979. And now it's already established in all those countries here in Africa, and here in Spain, Portugal, and France, and also occur in the south part of the United States. So the idea is to look for natural enemies in Brazil. Although we don't know the origin of the pest, there's some phylogenetic studies done a couple years ago. And actually, those studies were done in just a few isolates. And we can see that the Brazilian biotype of the mite is more similar to the European biotypes, and compare, for example, with the biotypes from Africa. So I think you still don't know the how this mite has been disseminating, the dispersion of the mite through many countries. But I think we need more sample Well, Brazil is a huge country. I think two samples would not enough to trace the origin here. Anyway, this is one of the mites that produce most web, I think, compared with other spider mites. You always can see if a plant is highly infested, you're going to see a lot of web covering the plant, like we have here. You see a lot of mites trying to disperse. You know, they use this strategy, and then the wind just blows them for other plants. It caused up to 9% of yield reduction in tomato in Zimbabwe. It was used to be a pest in Brazil, I just mentioned now before the 80s. It's not a problem anymore. The problem is that the farmers in Africa, they only rely on use of acaricide, but most of the farmers, they're small farmers, they have low input, so they don't have the proper equipment and techniques to use acaricide, so the damage is really important for the small farmers in Africa. Also, the mite has a great reproductive capacity. It means that it can also, it's a parthenogenetic mite, it can develop resistance to acaricides very fast. So other thing, the tomato is planted all year long, and there's also other solanaceous plant that can be used as a host for the mite. And for this reason, I think the classical biocontrol approach is the most interesting one, because it's a self-regulating, it's a simple and adaptive, and it's an expensive means of intervention. We have done some searches in Brazil, and also we found the pathogen Nosegaides floridana in Peru, in Argentina, and semi-arid place of Brazil, also in the coast. And the only other natural enemy associated with this mite is a predatory mite. It's a phytosaid mite. The name is Phytoseudus longipes. And this was only found in one small area in Brazil. And actually, this predatory mite is already in Africa, was sent, it was introduced to Africa. It's probably going to be being released right now. And this is another example where you have, a carologist working the project. And although it seems that the fungus is the most efficient one, but we need to do a lot of studies before we introduce, and then people start to release predators before we are actually able to introduce the pathogen. We have some questions when you start to work with this. The first one is just, when you collect in the field the tomato red spider mite infected with Nosegaides, we also find other spider mites infected, such as the two-spotted spider mite, and here the Tetranicus ludenis, another red mite. So you want to know if the same fungus was infecting different host species, because although I mentioned that there are more than 16 species of spider mite infected by the same fungus Nosegaides floridana, nobody have ever checked if the same strain is able to survive in different hosts. So we compare this with seven species of spider mite, different genus, and what we see is that usually the fungus only cause high mortality on the same host where it was isolated. For example, here the pathogen that isolated from Tetranicus evans caused 53% mortality to the tomato red spider mite only. And although you see here 14 or 9% infection, you usually don't see mummification. It means that the pathogen is not able to produce a lot of conidia. They probably have a broad host range in terms of they can survive in another host, but they're probably going to be efficient against only a single host. Same thing here. This pathogen was collecting tomato plant on two-spotted spider mite, and it's mostly efficient against the two-spotted spider mite. The other question we had is just, Solanaceous plant, they have a lot of plant defense compounds against herbivore. So they have all the glycoalkaloids, all the compounds that affect the pests and also the natural enemies. For example, two-spotted spider mite has been controlled by phytoseid predatory mites in many countries. For example, Phytoseulus persimilis is the most used predator mite against the two-spotted spider mite in many places, except on Solanaceous. This predator doesn't work very well in Solanaceous plant. So you want to see if the fungus would be able also to control the red spider mite in different Solanaceous plants. We compare this with on Solano americano, this is the nightshade plant. It's an important crop in Africa also. In Kenya, they eat the leaves of the nightshade plant, although in many places just consider weed. Eggplant, pepper, tomato, wild tomato, and then we see that in most cases we have a very high infection level of Tetanicus evansi, the tomato spider mite. And although we have some difference in terms of mummification, it seems that all those hosts will be good alternate hosts for the mite and also for the pathogen. We're currently doing some epizootiological studies. We don't have much data now, but this is just the data from the northeast part of the country, and we see always see that after the fungus to show up, you see a lot of infection, and then the population crash, and most of them might die here. So, of course, in this project, at least the cassava green mite part has been going on for a long time. There are many people that collaborate here, so I just list the name of the institutions that are collaborating the project. The cassava green mite project is coordinated by the International Institute for Tropical Agriculture and Cornell University in Brazil, Embrapa, and University of São Paulo, and also the International Center for Tropical Agriculture in Colombia. The tomato red spider mite project is it's coordinated by the International Center for Insect Physiology in Kenya. And there are two Brazilian institutions here, the universities that are participating in this project. So we're planning for the next year to start the process to introduce the Snellsogiates floridana strains from Brazil into Kenya to release to control the tomato red spider mite. Okay, that's it. We're trying to do that, you know, but I think we're really far from getting any result. I mean, this fungus is very difficult to grow in artificial media, and actually only grow in very expensive media. So even when you start, when you get some conidia from in vitro culture, the conidia is not virulent. So I think we're really far from. We're trying to do this more as conservation. So it has been in use, for example, in cotton to control aphid species in the United States is just to monitor the infection level. What they do is just, you know, they collect samples from the field. If you have like 5% infection, and then you don't need to spray anything because you know that the fungus is going to control the aphid, the cotton aphid, for example. So we're trying to also do this, and I think it's really important is to manage the crop in terms of not using fungicide. That's what we've seen. We have seen a lot of spider mite problem in Brazil now. You know, after you get the rust fungus disease in soybean, and then you start to have problems spider mite because people are spraying a lot of fungicide. And then you go and check, you see that you are disrupting the fungal pattern that was controlling spider mite. In most cases, I think we don't have many species of spider mite that are really important pest, except in those cases when you have, you know, system that's not balanced. Here or in Europe?
I live in the U.S.
In the U.S.?
I live in the U.S. still.
Okay.
You'll have to double check on that, but I've been reading that recently in the literature. So that would make a very nice match, depending on if that 5 or 6% of the species does well against your red tomato.
Well, it's good to know. I mean, we just submit a paper and, you know, a reviewer comments something like that. So, okay, well, even predator mite, they don't work very well on tomato plants. Or, so, I didn't know that.
In the U.S. with the Neosogiates with cotton aphid, there were sort of within season attempts to jumpstart epizootics earlier in the season. Are there any grassroots efforts in some of these places where it's been introduced to take take plants or infected plants at peak epizootic levels and move them to other geographic regions to I mean, you could do the initial inoculation.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I know that the cotton aphid project also, I mean, they have done some classical biocontrol here in the United States, just moving the pathogen from one place to another. I don't remember exactly what the state. I mean, I know the Arkansas had been used. They tried to introduce, I'm not sure if it's in California, but and they were able to start epizootic. So it's another option also to start, you know, early epizootic in the field.
In California, the environment wasn't right. What they were trying to do is the epizootic started in southern U.S. Sweep up to Arkansas. So they're trying to get it earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
But in a situation where the environment's correct, but it's just inoculation in Africa, it might be interesting to...
So this is, I believe that's the way to go. I mean, if you think how the epizootic start in the field, usually people tend to say that you only have high infection level when the density of the host is high. I mean, it's a density-dependent manner. So my impression is that usually the pathogens in the soil as a resting spore. So how the pathogen is going to, you know, come from the soil into the plant? You know, maybe a drop of water during the rain, or maybe when the infestation is high, so some mites are trying to disperse with the wind, I just show, and they fall on the ground, and they contaminate and come up to the leaf. So that's why people sometimes say, okay, this is the density-dependent, you know, relationship. So if you could get the pathogen from the field early to the crop, so you, I think the pathogen would do a good job in terms of controlling. So that's what they're seeing now in Norway. So in strawberry, but in this case, the pathogen overwinter hibernating females of the mite. So when the female comes to the plant, it's already bringing the pathogen. So the epizootic started much earlier. So that's something you have to learn.